From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee. If you saw the movie Swiss Army Man, you probably remember the music. We'll talk with Manchester Orchestra, the Georgia-based band behind that film's soundtrack. But first, we talked about Georgians' worst driving habits and asked you to vent your road rage.
This is Edward Austin Hall calling from the gorgeous but automotively dangerous Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. Atlantans, you do not live in London. Please stay to the right side of the center line unless some city official is directing you to go around. People cross the center line to park on the left side of the street all the time, and guess what? It's illegal and it's dangerous. I almost got run over by somebody driving on the left side of the road.
Here are your first thoughts. Carly Cooper tweets, I hate when people in the left lane drive so fast they don't give you a chance to get over to the right lane, then come around you. Neil Cassidy says, we are the worst at using the little lever on the left of the steering wheel. Maybe the newer vehicles don't have one? Joel Cook says, I have never seen so many people ignore stop signs and crosswalks. I've lived in New York, Florida, and South Carolina, and no one is worse than the people in Georgia. We always want to know what you think. Call us, but not while you're driving, please. 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. A recent report puts Georgia 41st in the nation for its quality of senior health. According to America's Health Rankings Senior Report, that's two slots lower than last year. For more on the general health of seniors in Georgia and the issue of elder abuse, I talked with Kathy Floyd. She is the executive director for the Georgia Council on Aging. I also spoke with Glenn Oster. Glenn is director of the Institute of Gerontology at the University of Georgia. I want to first get to this issue of elder abuse and why it continues to be a problem, a problem that persists. We took this up with Robert Bush. He is a senior staff attorney for Georgia Legal Services in Savannah. He works on civil cases, including many with the elderly at the center of those cases. Here he is talking about the problem of elder abuse in Georgia.
I think the issue persists, again, because, you know, you have people who are out there who have no compunction about taking advantage of individuals who you can't take care of and can't defend and sometimes can't do some basic transactions for themselves.
Glenn, you say Georgia is bad when it comes to community and environment engagement. How does that lack of engagement factor into elder abuse?
Well, I think it's everything is connected. So, yes, there's lack of engagement at the community level, and that is perhaps a process from both the top down and bottom up. The top down meaning what can our institutions, governments, and so forth do to better regulate the industry and make sure that there are qualified people who are well-educated, who understand their position and their role in looking after elders. But it also from the bottom up, so to speak, on the individual level and the family level, is there's an education and awareness that needs to be put in place so people understand the dynamics of when your loved one is in a, whether it's an assisted living facility or a nursing home, that there are certain things that take place and that if both sides are better educated, again, from the top down and bottom up on what really is important to both sides in providing really good quality of care and have sort of a meeting of the minds of both sides and saying this is, you know, having some metrics in place and standardizations on trying to improve the care so everyone benefits, both the employer, the employee, and also the person, the consumer, receiving the benefits of that care.
Kathy, what, from your perspective, is the problem with the quality of care for seniors in Georgia?
Well, you have with our rankings, you do have a low ranking for nursing home quality, and that is definitely an issue in Georgia. But part of the reason for that is that we have one of the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rates in the country. Almost 80% of nursing home beds are paid for with Medicaid. And so when you pay less, you get less. And so one of the things that we need to do, frankly, is increase that reimbursement rate mm-hmm. and tie it to quality. And one of the things that we're looking at is having the direct care workers, those folks that do the majority of the hands-on work, paid at least $10 an hour. And we think that is a possible way to get at some of these problems.
Well, you also say that seniors have not really been a focus of lawmakers. I know that's something that you're working on. And Robert Bush points that out as well. He agrees with you on this point.
Well, we have another abuse prosecutor here in Savannah, and I think there are others across the state. However, that is not in every county. The critical support that is required to develop a case, in many cases, financial forensic investigators often are not funded.
Kathy, what does it look like if lawmakers are more engaged on this?
Well, we have seen a difference in just the last couple of years. This year in the legislature, they funded the creation of a position for a statewide prosecutor. And this will get at something that Robert is talking about, because you have different counties that are able to do different things. Frankly, here in the metro area, Cobb County is excellent. They do a great job. But a smaller county doesn't have the resources. So this statewide prosecutor will be able to go into different counties and be able to help them prosecute the wrongdoers. And that's a win-win. One of the things we're looking at doing is asking all of the major candidates for governor next year to make senior issues a priority. And I think with the numbers that we're looking at and the increases in the numbers of seniors and the numbers that are facing elder abuse and problems with hunger, problems with home care, staying independent, I think that will be a win-win.
You know, Glenn, I want to get back to this question of education. You know, we should all be so lucky to live long enough to live a life where we have great care around us as we age. What is it that we need to know as we age, and what do our family members need to know in terms of making sure that great quality of care is available?
Well, I think a part of education is an awareness of the various factors. And both, when I say factors, I mean awareness and education, both formal and informal education, of those factors that will diminish our quality of life, but also looking at factors and having people have this awareness of what can they do when they're younger to have sort of over a life course, so they hopefully insure themselves or at least give themselves a greater opportunity to age well or to have that quality of life. So I think education is a major, major part of it.
Is that education, and again, Glenn, sorry to interrupt, but is that education readily available? I mean, is it easily accessible?
I would think not. And when I speak of education, that could be ongoing campaigns, you know, from the government level. It could be starting right in our classrooms and educating those in grade school and high school and university about the process of aging and aging well and some of the factors that they may encounter as they age or as they see their parents age or grandparents age. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be formal education, but some sort of campaign that people start understanding that these are the issues that will happen to me. And I think you have to make it personal. These are the issues that will happen to me or my family at some point. And to another point is this really should be a priority, you know, because right now about 15% of the U.S. population is 65 or older.
Yeah, yeah.
Within a decade or two, that's going to be 20, 21, 22%. That's going to be a huge number of individuals who are going through different scenarios in their life that they didn't have when they were younger, you know, in terms of chronic conditions, perhaps lack of independence, cognitive issues,
right.
Caregiver issues. And so, again, having some sort of understanding, and I use the word education, or awareness that we need to invest resources, we need to have awareness of how to handle various situations
sure.
as they arise and become personal.
And Kathy, will you take on this question of food insecurity for seniors? It's shocking what's in the report, and it's shocking to hear you talk about food insecurity and the problem that it is for seniors here in Georgia.
It is. The report shows that nationally, the increase is about 16% in the last year on this. And unfortunately, in Georgia, we're up 18% with food insecurity. And this is
does that mean, food insecurity?
Well, the definition of food insecurity is the percentage of seniors facing the threat of hunger. So you have seniors that are buying their prescription drugs and not buying food. You can hear this from folks that are, you know, not just poverty folks. And it is a, you know, an issue of nutrition, not only to give them nutrition, but also the health benefits. And there are a lot of health problems that come when you're not getting the correct nutrition. So it is a real issue. Now, the good news is that Georgia is having its second annual Senior Hunger Summit in September, September 28th and 29th. And this is an initiative of the Georgia Department of Human Services to bring together stakeholders. Mm-hmm. This is elected officials. This is advocates. This is the...
And when is that happening?
September 28th and 29th. It's going to be at the Marriott Century Center right here in Atlanta. And
there's more information available?
Yes,
on
the the Department of Human Services website. You can also find it on our website,
right.
Georgia Council on Aging.
Kathy, thank you so much. Kathy Floyd is the Executive Director of the Georgia Council on Aging. And you've also heard from Glenn Oster. He is Dr. Glenn Oster, Director of the Institute of Gerontology at UGA. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Georgia's own Manchester Orchestra is out with a new album. But first, is it time to phase out privately run immigration detention centers? This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. A debate is going on over the operation of immigration detention centers. Georgia's Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin is one of the largest in the country. In a letter to the prison and the private prison company running the facility, the Southern Poverty Law Center says detainees are waiting hours to see their attorney. SPLC attorney Lisa Graybill spoke with WABE in Atlanta.
Attorneys have been unable to get to speak with their clients because they were kept waiting in the waiting room, and their client's moment in court, you know, came and went while the attorney was still outside.
Graybill says Stewart's practice of banning electronic devices adds to the delays. But ICE says the detention facility is in full compliance with federal law and agency policy, and that attorneys should schedule appointments in advance. The SPLC says it's put ICE and the private prison company CoreCivic on notice for the barriers it's identified. but the group hasn't filed a lawsuit. In December, a U.S. Department of Homeland Security subcommittee recommended continuing the use of private immigrant detention facilities with greater oversight. A Homeland Security Advisory Council, however, didn't agree with the report's recommendation regarding private detention centers and said that they should be phased out. My colleague, Celeste Headley, spoke more about this last year with Azadeh Shashahani. She's the legal and advocacy director for Project South. That's a nonprofit group dedicated to social justice issues.
So let's go first to the advisory council that said these privately run facilities should be phased out. What was their reasoning?
Well, so the subcommittee came out with a report first saying that there needs to be better oversight of these facilities, but because of the rising population of detained immigrants, the government has no choice but to rely on privatized detention facilities for now.
That's the subcommittee that wants to continue using them.
Right. And then the report went to the advisory committee to the Department of Homeland Security, and there was really a stunning outcome. So 3/4 of the members of the advisory committee decided to adopt the recommendations on better oversight of facilities generally, but they decided to oppose the recommendation of the report on basically continuing with privatized detention. They felt that the government needs to really make an effort to phase out privatized detention facilities.
And why?
Because of, the record of abuse by private prison corporations, because they don't actually substantially save on cost, and because, as a Department of Justice report had indicated earlier, there is shortcomings on a variety of fronts, such as safety and security in facilities run by private corporations.
Now, according to the USA Today, a spokesman for the private detention contractor CoreCivic said this, quote, the company supports the needs of our government partner while providing a safe, humane, and appropriate environment for those entrusted to our care, end quote. And another private detention firm, GEO Group, says it has a long history of, quote, providing culturally responsive, safe, and humane environments that meet the non-penal needs of those individuals entrusted to the care of ICE, that's the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, end quote. What are the abuses that bothered the advisory council that they said they had strong evidence for?
Well, so, there have been uprisings at facilities run by private corporations, including two hunger strikes here, protesting the conditions.
Here in Georgia.
Here in Georgia, at the Stewart Detention Center in summer of 2014 and fall of 2015, there were two hunger strikes and protests by immigrant detainees at the Stewart Detention Center, protesting the conditions, including reports of maggots being found in the food and the treatment that they were receiving by the guards. So that's just one example here in Georgia. Across the country, you have situations where the food is sometimes not edible or is not enough. There is not enough safety or security for the immigrants or for the employees at that facilities, because, again, the corporation is trying to maximize profits and cut corners.
How long does the average immigrant spend in one of these? Once they arrive at the center, how long are they usually there for?
It depends. It depends whether they're fighting their case or they have already agreed to be deported. If they have agreed to be deported, it could be a couple months or longer. If they're fighting their case, they're afraid of going back to their home country because they could be tortured or they could face persecution, it could be years. And so, because of the conditions at these facilities, some immigrants might actually sign away their rights and decide to return back despite the risk that they face, because they don't want to, stay for years at one of these detention centers with the poor conditions that we just talked about.
What are the, if an immigrant arrives at one of these centers, what rights do they have, and how are they different from an inmate who's an American citizen at, say, a prison or private prison?
So, one thing to keep in mind is that these immigration detention centers are civil institutions. The purpose is not really to punish anyone. The purpose is just to keep people until they're hearing. But the way these detention centers are run is actually more of a penal nature, you know, meant to punish people. So, you know, there are, again, reports of verbal abuse by some of the guards. Sometimes the sexual abuse has been documented. The hygiene issue, the work program where the basically immigrants at the facility are doing the work that the corporation would have had to hire regularly paid employees at regular wages. Immigrants at these facilities are performing sometimes in unsafe working conditions for between $1 to $4 a day.
So there are a few big questions now. The first is whether or not the recommendations of the advisory council were going to be adopted, whether their recommendation that privately run centers be phased out, whether that would actually occur. Let's deal with the first one, and whether or not there's an intention to actually phase out these privately run centers.
Well, that is the hope. There are unfortunate signals coming from Trump in terms of his affinity for privatized corporations, I mean, privatized detention centers, and also his stated intent to crack down on immigrants and potentially deport 2 to 3 million immigrants, which, if that is actually carried out, would mean that the population of detained immigrants would rise just astronomically. Yeah.
Okay, so this leaves us where? I mean, for example, the Stewart Detention in Lumpkin, it is a huge facility. Are they just sort of waiting to find out what happens?
Well, you know, stock prices rose a lot after the election results.
Stock prices for privately run prisons.
Exactly. For example, for CCA and the GEO group, after the election results were announced, just because they could see what was coming. But, you know, I think we have to continue to push on this front. I think the recommendation from the advisory committee is very positive that we need to continue to build on and really communicate the message to the new administration that it makes no sense either on the safety or security or human rights or cost front to continue to deal with private corporations for running of our prisons.
We only have about a minute left. So without getting into the minute legal details, does the recommendation of the advisory council actually give immigrants who are in one of these centers a legal standard to argue in court?
Unfortunately not, but it sets a good precedent.
That's Azadeh Shashahani of the group Project South, speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. So let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. All week, we've been hearing from artists performing at Brag Jam in Macon. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are pretty simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't pick one of their own songs. Today, we feature Vanessa Briscoe Hay, formerly the frontwoman of the legendary Athens band Pylon. Now she's singing with the Pylon Reenactment Society. Here are her picks.
Hi, this is Vanessa Briscoe Hay. I'm speaking to you from Athens, Georgia, and I'm the singer for Pylon, Supercluster, and now Pylon Reenactment Society. Today, my first pick for the Georgia playlist is one of my favorite songs from 1968. It's by the Classics Four, and it's called Spooky.
First you say no, you got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say,
what you've got is you've got a band who's telling a story about a spooky little girl like you in 3 minutes. It has a really nice kind of jazzy, bluesy bottom to it. It kind of snakes around and twists in there. The saxophone is very important. There's a, I guess it's maybe a progenitor of what became soft rock. Spooky is a very appropriate name for the song.
Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl like you. Spooky.
song itself was actually taken from a jazz standard, and some members of the Classics Four had decided to add lyrics to it. It started out as a jazz saxophone, kind of bluesy kind of song, and then when you hear the song, you'll hear the lyrics as it's playing, but it kind of appealed to me as a kid because it was talking about a girl who was a little bit different. Spooky little girl like you. Spooky. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is from 1978 by Atlanta's own The Brains, and it's called Money Changes Everything. It goes out to my dear friend, Margaret Adams. You know, it kind of represents what Atlanta was about at the time. It's very poppy, very well written, and synthesizer driven. Tom Gray released this initially as a single, and on the basis of the single, The Brains were signed to Mercury Records. This is just like a perfect pop song. They're like at the top of their game. The instruments are all very together, very professional sounding, which was maybe more of a hallmark to an Atlanta sound than Athens. I mean, there were a lot of bands that never really got signed or moved beyond the area. The Brains were one of the ones who did. When you hear a really good pop song like that, you realize what makes it tick. And to me, the clearness of the lyrics and the sentiment really come through. It's a just very punchy, very hooky pop song. I don't know that Pylon were ever accused of being very hooky or punchy or any of that. We were maybe left field from that. But I can say that I enjoyed that, and I had many friends in Atlanta who were associated with that band.
That singer Vanessa Briscoe Hay with the Athens group Pylon Reenactment Society. They will perform at Bragg Jam in Macon this Saturday. That's at 9:30 p.m. at Fresh Produce Records. And just ahead, Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra has been busy since scoring last year's Swiss Army Man. They've got a new record out this weekend, and we'll get a preview. This is On Second Thought. I It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. You've most likely heard music by the Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra, even if you don't know it. Musicians Andy Hull and Robert McDowell scored the 2016 cult film Swiss Army Man with Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano. And if you missed that one, maybe you've seen them playing big festivals like Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, or Shaky Knees. The band has been going strong since 2004, and now they're about to release their fifth studio album, A Black Mile to the Surface. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke last week with the powerhouse duo behind Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hull and Robert McDowell.
So I get Manchester, named after the city in England. Why orchestra?
Well, when I started the band, it was the second band that I ever started in high school, and so the first one broke up, and I was over the drama and the politics of having to deal with the, other people. So I thought it would be cool to have a band where I could be the leader, and that's behind the title.
So what do you think, if you look back at the beginnings when you first got into the group, name a song for me in the album that's like the farthest away from where you were.
On the new album from where we were then?
Yeah. What's the biggest journey?
I think a song like The Alien, where we're now able to have complex parts but contain them and not have to rely on dynamics and angst and
volume
to relay the emotion. We've learned how to strip away and approach with the less is more, but still hopefully achieve the same emotions.
Mm-hmm. Made a pact with you and God. If you don't move, I swear to you, I'm gonna make you. Do you need
So you guys have stayed with indie labels. Why?
Somewhat, yeah. Well, I mean, the first label that we started our first label, I started it back when we released our very first EP in like 2005. And so we did a deal with Columbia Records underneath Sony that they would sort of buy or lease our record label and give us a budget to help release other records as well. But we still had a major label machine at our disposal to use certain aspects of it. We were always very weary of it at the beginning because all we'd heard were horror stories about bands signing too big a deals and then labels leaving them. And so we tried to be conscious and smart about what deals we were making. So we've really more found a way to hold on to the DIY mentality and the indie mentality, but we've also been able to partner with people who get that and have been able to give us, you know, a lot of great opportunities.
And Robert, what do you think that does for you to sort of steer away from the I guess music making machine that is, say, Columbia?
Well, I think the faster you rise, the faster you fall. And we're a band that we want to have 5 records, 10 records, 15 records, and
well, you have 5.
Yeah. Halfway there.
Yeah.
And I think when you partner with the right partner and they know that you're not looking for the biggest single in the world, you're looking for the best piece of art you can make right now, they let you control it more. And it gives you creative control to make the record you want to make instead of the record that's going to be the biggest success in this small window.
So let's talk a little bit about scoring a movie. And first, let's hear the finale song from the soundtrack of the 2016 film Swiss Army Man. What is the difference in music making and songwriting for you between making something for an album and making something for a film?
Well, an obvious difference for this particular score that we did was that we weren't allowed to use, for about 95% of the score, we weren't allowed to use any instruments. So it was all just my voice or the actor's voices or Robert's voice. So that was kind of like taking a, you know, not wanting to go to school, like I said before, but that was truly like a master's thesis of relearning how to make music and relearning how new ways to create atmosphere. And that's something that was heavily influential for us on this new album, because we had to learn how to make music without words that conveyed an emotional kind of hit you in the heart feeling. And we also had to do it in the span of, in some instances, 15 to 30 seconds. So how do you make a heartbreaking song in 15 seconds? And the score sort of taught us through over a 13-month headbanging on the wall experience how to do that and how to create these sort of sonic landscapes that we weren't really that focused on mm-hmm. in previous Manchester records.
And it also, it was nice creating something that isn't the main art piece. You're adding to someone else's vision. And I would say for our pride, that kind of like checks you a little bit. So going into this album, we were very open to like, well, yeah, like bring that to the table. We weren't so gung-ho on being the alpha male in the room. It was a lot warmer.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear another clip from that film. This is called Talk to Her. Shades of the Beach Boys there.
Sure.
and we can sort of hear your problem solving and how you got around not using instruments. But I wonder if you could ever see yourself, you know, you see, look at somebody like Danny Elfman who said, all right, as soon as I started scoring movies, that was it. I was done with pop music. Hmm. Did you feel a sort of pull to do this again?
I think it more so influenced how we look at everything now. And for this Manchester record to really try and create an album within an album of sonic landscapes. And we wanted the album to sort of seem like a house where every different song is a room that you're in and it's this different feeling. And we learned a ton of that from the score. It was very hard to do. I mean, it took us 13 months from start to finish to work on the score. So it wasn't something that we were like signing up for immediately. It would have to be something that we really believed in and cared about enough to put our hearts and brains into it for that long again.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with two of the members of Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hall and Robert McDowell. Then you just mentioned the new album, so let's hear another clip off the new album. This is called The Gold.
Ceiling. I don't think I love you anymore. That gold mine changed you. You don't have to hold me anymore. Our cave's collapsing. I don't want to be me anymore.
So one of the great things about you guys is you sound just as good live as you do on your album. Like nobody's going to hear your music in the album and then go to the concert and be disappointed. That pleases me as a musician.
Yeah.
But there are other people for whom that's, you know, that's not a big deal, right? I mean, like for other people, the craft of sort of engineering the perfect sound mm-hmm. is the most important thing. And I wonder where you fall on that spectrum, whether it matters to you if a band or a singer can go and reproduce the same thing live.
I don't look down on somebody who can't pull off what's going on the album.
Because we've made records like that. Like we obviously couldn't pull off the Swiss Army Man score. We've
right.
made solo records that there
well,
isn't
yeah,
a band.
Yeah, because you're layering your voice. But that's not exactly what I'm talking about,
right?
I'm talking about someone who needs an engineer to clean up the sound, to clean up the vocals. And
you know, if that person is a creative mind, you know, like somebody just totally outside of the box, what we're talking about, somebody like Kanye West, for example, is not a good singer, but has used technology and a ton of, you know, cool creative ways to make himself a good singer. I think that's amazing. I think there aren't any rules to creating music, and there shouldn't be any rules to creating amazing music. And if that means you have to put it through 100 different computers, as long as it sounds dope at the end of it, then you're in a good spot, you know? And I think technology now allows people to do that live and to recreate things like that with auto-tune, etc. For us, I think this just kind of goes back to our DIY roots and spending hundreds of days on the road for several years, the early part of our career. I don't know. I guess I just feel fortunate that we can sing and we can sing live. Because if we couldn't, I'm sure I would be using all the other tricks.
Okay, let's hear a little more music. This is an older tune, actually. This is not from the new album. This one is called Shake It Out. It's from Mean Everything Did Nothing.
Shake it out, shake it out. Gotta need another and another and another and another. I can feel it now. I felt alone in my father's house. And I can see, standing when we were 17. Make it clean. Are you the living ghost of what I need? Are you gonna get the best of me? We will see.
Do you think we can hear Georgia in your music?
There's definitely some Georgia, but I don't know if it's the same like Southern rock that you would classify.
Like the Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
Surely. I mean, certainly there's, you know, it might be more, you know, Neil Young, which isn't Southern rock, but it's still, there's definitely that there, this sort of swamp Southern gothic thing that we like to dive into from time to time. I think it depends on the record that you're listening to, because all of our records sound a whole lot different from each other. So I think like on our third record, there was definitely more of a Southern, you know, mm-hmm. element to it, where our fourth record probably not so much.
So, well, then let's hear from the third album. The third album was Simple Math, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this is actually the title track off that album. Easily one of the best lines. What if I was wrong and nobody cared to mention? So great. So then how do you stay together? Because it doesn't matter when what era we're talking mm-hmm. about. It is hard, especially when you're touring and mm-hmm. you're stuck in close quarters for yeah. long periods of time. That is hard. How do you make it work?
Well, I'm fortunate because Robert's my best friend, also is my brother-in-law, so he's sort of trapped in this relationship with me.
Right, you can't totally be mean to him or your sister's going to come down on you.
Well, sure.
But I also think we have a understanding in a relationship where we do bicker a lot because we don't have time to navigate feelings, especially in the studio where what I'm saying is harsh and would hurt my wife's feelings. I don't care if they hurt his feelings right. because it's for the greater good. And, well, and same if it comes like towards me.
We can't have feelings during that process. It's like you got to kind of throw out your personal, you know, side of if this idea is good or if this idea is not. And ultimately, I think the thing that keeps it together is having a group of people, and especially with Robert and Tim and Andy. Everyone's dedicated to the same thing. We want to make the best possible record that we can.
So let's listen to one more song from the new album. That this track is The Sunshine.
I already know that I don't already know. You are sunlight. I don't really care if you don't understand. You are moonlight. And that's all right.
What do you like about this album?
I like it because nothing was left untouched. And sometimes we added too much stuff and we would have to strip it away. Sometimes we wouldn't add enough stuff. But I know that everything on this record is intentional and there's not really anything that I see myself looking back on being like, I wish I would have done that different, because with everything, we tried it differently and we're committed that that's the best thing we can do. It's the best album we can make. So I'm very, very proud of that.
Yeah, I'm just proud that we stuck with it. You know, it was a 6-month process and you know, there was a mental breakdown at 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and we always rallied and said, all right, I'm getting up tomorrow. I'm going to continue down our voyage of trying to find the next cool keyboard sound and, you know, try not to kill ourselves in the process. And when you finally reached that point where we had a rule, you know, for we wouldn't be happy with a song until we were jumping up and down. And like, that's how we knew we would love the song. And it took like 3 months for us to get that on one song. And when we finally got it, it was like, all right, well, we know it's possible. We just have to do it 10 more times. And then putting the work in and making that happen and actually jumping up and down for 11 songs and realizing this record is what we had, as close as to what we dreamed as it could be. Yeah, there's just a sense of joy and satisfaction with that. And now it's like, you know, you let it go and it's, you let people have it now.
You know, the process that you're describing is not what a lot of teenagers think of when they think that they're going to be in a successful band, right?
Correct.
They do not think of it as being mean to each other because it's about business and it's not personal. They don't think about getting up early in the morning and slaving away and being slightly OCD about all the details, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what advice would you give to us?
Run. Get into it for the right reason, because unless you really love making music and being a musician,
it's not worth it.
There's not enough money or fame to balance it out.
Yeah.
So you got to do it for the art.
Yeah, if you can find, if that's your happy place, is pushing yourself to be creative and to try new things and realize that it's going to be hard forever. And like every record we put out, it just gets harder and harder to try and find something that is original and interesting and inspiring for us, much less thinking about what listeners would want to hear. But if that's something you really love and that makes you feel all weird and fuzzy inside, then do it.
That is Andy Hull and Robert McDowell. They are half of the Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra. Their new album is out this week. It's A Black Mile to the Surface, and we'll go out with their new song, The Moth. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. But we always love to hear your comments. If you have some thoughts about stories we should be covering or music we should be jamming to, give us a call. Leave us a message at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.